Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today on The Charlie Kirk Show, I sit down with the interesting, the complex, and the brilliant Michael Knowles for a conversation about Catholicism, the death penalty, President Trump, and more. This is a lively discussion, kind of goes into a debate, but it's all done with lighthearted respect for each other. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, your home for conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Before we go further, before I say begin, go to your podcast app, type in The Charlie Kirk Show, press subscribe, leave a review. Again, Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, your home of conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here. All right, everybody. We have a special edition here of the Charlie Kirk Show with none other than Michael Knowles. Did you come from Mass?
I did not come straight from Mass, though I guess I'm always coming from Mass in a certain sense. The whole week begins on Sunday. I walk out that door and I...
Do you go
I'm
every
here
day?
To, I'm here. No, I don't go to daily. I go weekly, at least weekly, and then I get to come and evangelize people like you, Charlie.
Do Catholics evangelize?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We try. Sometimes we even proselytize.
Interesting.
Although, so I guess you could call me an evangelical that way.
So, yeah, when people lowercase. Call themselves an evangelical Catholic, what does that mean?
You know what it really means? It's because there are so many people who are cradle Catholics who don't know anything about the faith and don't go to Mass, and so they call themselves culturally Catholic. And then there are – actually what I've noticed is the people who actually believe it, who actually go out and really want to convince people, they were all either converts or reverts.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of – like me, I was away for 10 years. I was an atheist for 10 years.
You were an atheist?
I was.
What changed you from atheism to rational thinking?
Rational thinking actually is. I fell away when I was 13, back when it was very popular, you know, Christopher Hitchens, Richard
sure.
Dawkins, all of that. And because 13-year-old boys are arrogant and they're prideful and they're ignorant. And at that time, Christopher Hitchens was making these arguments that I thought were compelling. They're really only compelling for 13-year-olds. Within about 6 or 7 years, I encountered actually a Calvinist philosopher, Alvin Plantinga.
So there was a good thing out of the Calvinist tradition.
There was. I mean,
we got
at least one, you know. And it was this guy, Alvin Plantinga, did a version of the ontological argument, which goes all the way back to St. Anselm of Canterbury. And very few people are brought back to the faith by this, but it got me, and it started a process that went about 4 or 5 years, and then, you know, things happened gradually, then suddenly, and...
I think Hemingway said that.
I think it was Hemingway, of all people.
Not Molly Hemingway.
Not Molly, though she could have too. She's very wise.
Ernest Hemingway. So I want to get into a lot of different things. For those people that aren't so familiar, you host a podcast, which everyone should go download and subscribe.
Yes.
And you were nice enough to have me on your podcast.
You were great. That was a very popular episode.
So this is actually a quid pro quo.
And this, we're engaging. When do we get impeached?
Hopefully, well, who would impeach us?
Media Matters, I think. They try to impeach us every day.
That's right. Yeah, it would be. So,
and maybe Adam Schiff, too.
This is actually what a quid pro quo looks like. So if anyone is confused and we colluded.
Yeah. Which one of us is the Ukrainian?
Well, I'm not sure which one of them. Yes. However, this is legitimate quid pro quo. I loved coming on your podcast. It was a lot of fun. So we could talk about what we agree on a lot, but I want to talk about things. I have no idea what you stand on.
All right.
And then I can maybe press on it. And I know we disagree on some other things. And so with your permission.
Lay it on me.
Okay,
I'm
good.
Ready.
I always
I'm
ask
strong.
People for their permission just because I'm so used to it on college campus. I don't think you're one of those people that needs it. Okay.
Well, it's the Me Too movement, so everybody needs consent for everything. So you have my consent.
So the first question, Donald Trump, best president or greatest president?
That is a very difficult one. I'd like to go the third option. He is the most greatest, terrificest president of my lifetime.
So you're MAGA.
I think the guy's great. I think he's terrific. I don't know if he's the greatest president ever, because I still think Washington kind of edges him out. Maybe Reagan, but he's...
No, I've never said he was the greatest. I said he could be on pace to be the greatest.
He is.
And the greatest of our lifetime.
He's really terrific. I got to tell you, I was skeptical of him going in because I thought he might be half a Democrat, or he might be a liar. He might not be able to accomplish anything. He has exceeded my expectations time and time again. You know, the areas where he's done things I don't like... relatively few and far between. There have been some, but overall, I'm pleased as punch with the guy.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that, and I know some of our viewers are. We get plenty of hate viewers. You have a couple of those?
I have one or two, yeah. I
mean, one or 200,000.
Yeah.
So do you support the end of the war in Afghanistan?
What is the war in Afghanistan? I mean, this is like the war
like pulling, in Syria. Pulling troops out of Afghanistan.
Are we going to pull all the troops out? I don't know that I would pull all the troops out. I mean, we still have a lot of troops in Germany, have a lot of troops in South Korea, have a lot of troops all over the world, a lot of troops in Bahrain. We're not in war with Bahrain. So it depends what we mean by ending the war. I think this is basically the central question of the Trump era, and it's bigger than Trump, and it's bigger than mm-hmm. even the last 20 years. The question is, do we want to be an empire, or do we want to be a nation?
So which do you think is the correct answer?
I think the people are going back and forth every day. In the current system, obviously, we want a thriving system of nation states. We need a robust mm-hmm. sense of nationalism. Irving Kristol said, the great Kristol.
Jeez, don't get me started. His son believes in an empire.
His son wants an empire, it would seem. But he said—
Bill Kristol, for people I don't know. But yeah.
What Irving said was the three pillars of modern conservatism are religion, economic growth, and nationalism. And we're seeing this resurgence of the sense of the nation state. We don't like these imperial organizations, the IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations, mm-hmm. the European Union, NATO, frankly.
TPP, sure.
TPP. We're backing away from that. And so I see this on both sides of the aisle. You've had two presidents now, Obama and Trump, say we need to get out of the Middle East. They both won their elections. Clearly, the American people are sensing that. They want a return to nationalism. Our world system, the world order, is complicated in that we do operate as an empire in many ways. The question is, which direction are we going to move in? And clearly, it seems that the American people—
What do you believe?
I would favor a more robust nation state at the moment. I would mm-hmm. favor stronger borders. I would favor reducing our overseas commitments
yes.
militarily. I would favor— maybe engaging a little bit more in East Asia. I would favor mm-hmm. maybe a little bit more challenging China. I'm not convinced that we need to dedicate a whole lot of our military resources to the Middle East. I think
I completely agree with you.
Exactly. I mean, I think there are
the threats in China, not the Kandahar Valley.
And if we've been
bombed, I would withdraw completely from Afghanistan.
You'd pull every troop.
Every troop. Every troop.
What about Syria?
Very similar. But we did a whole podcast on it, and I was a little more nuanced.
Yes. I mean,
I think it's situation by situation.
Exactly. This is the issue.
My situation in Afghanistan is what does success look like?
Pull them all out.
Yes.
Does that mean negotiate with the Taliban?
Oh, yeah. We negotiated them in the 80s and 90s. They sat in the Oval Office with Reagan.
Right, right. We negotiated with them. That changed on 9/11, at least for 20
years. They weren't the only
years.
Actor.
Of course not. Of course not. But the question is, do we negotiate with them now? Do we bring them back in? Perhaps we do.
We negotiate. I mean, Turkey's in NATO, and Erdogan's
right.
a horrible guy.
Right, right. Yeah, Turkey's been in NATO 67 years.
Right. And so we have complicated relationships, and Taliban mm-hmm. would be one of them. I'm not saying to justify their killings or their brutality.
Barbarism, yeah.
No, but I think there's some merit to say there's an extent to our efficacy of getting involved in these endless
right.
conflicts.
And there are these two questions. On one, obviously, is what's the goal of the war? What does victory look like? No one's been
but
able to
if
answer
it was,
that.
If it was, we need to take out this guy because he attacked us, we're the best military in the world.
Right.
It would take an afternoon.
Right.
We're not a welfare system. At least we shouldn't be.
And ask yourself, even putting the nationalist argument aside, let's say you're going to make the imperial argument. What do we want in that situation? I mean, what does success look like even if we're just managing Afghanistan? What do we want Afghanistan to look like?
So there's two examples of where we have controlled two theaters, and I think we've done it too generously, is European and Asia. Now, Asia is de-emphasized, but post-World War II, we basically were like, y'all are not getting a military again.
Right.
It's worked. The Middle East, we've never made such – it's too tribal. It's not a sophisticated enough or connected enough economy for us ever to be able to do that.
Right. And there are too many sub-state actors. I mean, this is the issue with the Taliban. This is the issue with even our Kurdish friends in Syria. the United States cannot have permanent relationships with sub-state actors.
Yeah, the Syrian rebels were bad people too. It's not exactly like they were rebelling at something bad, but they themselves were also bad.
Of course, and there are so many actors in there that if you've got a conflict between our genuine allies, the Kurds, who are sub-state actors, and NATO allies, Turkey, allies for 67 years, what are you to make of that? This raises much bigger questions about our entanglements and our alliances and what the world order looks like after the Cold War. And we've never answered that question, not since the 92.
I think there's something to be said about we're fiscally crippling ourselves.
Yeah.
And I'm of the opinion, and I'm very critical of the neoconservative wing of the party, where it seems as if they can't find a country that they wouldn't invade.
I know. I'm all for invading Greenland. That's the only
one. I think we should purchase Greenland. I mean, we purchased the Dutch West Indies. I mean, that was fine.
Yeah.
But when it expands the interests of the nation state and understanding we're a benevolent superpower, I can sympathize with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a belief, and I love your opinion about this, is if a withdrawal from anywhere is a sign of weakness. And I don't see it that way.
No, certainly not. And even more than financial assets, because we got a lot of money in this country and our big financial problem is much more in domestic spending and specifically entitlement spending.
Totally.
But it's more being able to respond quickly to larger threats. Are we going to be able to respond to China if they aggress on our interests? In South China Sea, for instance?
No. I mean, right. But by the way, so what do you make of this whole appeasing Chinese Communist Party thing with the National Basketball Association?
You know what this shows you is he who pays the piper calls the tune. And we think that we can get away. We can run all of our entertainment on selling movies to China, selling basketball to China. We can fund our government, fund our wars overseas by having China buy up our debt. As though there's no cost to that. Of course there's a cost to that. He who pays the piper calls the tune. And it is so humiliating to watch American entertainment executives bending over backwards for China and more or less throwing Hong Kong under the bus.
The CCP is an evil regime.
Yes.
Evil. And I mean, I remember when the NBA was really, you know, they were protesting the North Carolina bathroom law. And they said, oh, this has no place in the National Basketball Association. But Muslims in concentration camps,
right.
Perfectly cool about
right.
that.
You can have concentration camps all throughout China, but you can't travel to North Carolina. You can't travel to Georgia. You can't travel to Alabama. I mean, that's hypocrisy of the highest order.
This fall, start a new monthly routine. You guys got to do this to upgrade your life. Mr. Producer talks so highly of this. He loves this stuff. It's really impressive. It's called Box of Awesome from Bespoke Post. I'm looking at this stuff, Weekender bag. It's more sophisticated than I realize. So whether you're looking to craft your own hard cider or toast perfectly aged fall cocktails, Box of Awesome has you covered. From style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear, Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. So basically, you go to this website, boxofawesome.com, and it just has all these amazing things that you want in your life. And they're kind of an interesting complexion of everything from shoes to bags to grooming kits to things you can make drinks with. They have toothbrush, a pocket knife, no matter what you guys want or what your interests are, essentially they take a profile of you and you then get it by subscription. So it's free to sign up. You can skip a month or cancel anytime. Each box costs only $45, but it has over $70 worth of gear. So again, there's no charge at all to sign up. You go to boxofawesome.com, enter the code Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E, that's C-H-A-R-L-I-E at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E for 20% off your first box. Again, I'm looking at this website right now. I'm kind of fascinated by it. And of course, help our friends out at Bespoke Post. Again, that's boxofawesome.com, code Charlie for 20% off your first box.
So you do a lot of college campus speaking.
Yes.
So do I. Do you ever get protested?
I once or twice have gotten some protests.
I saw the recent video, Georgetown.
That was at GW.
What's hilarious about it is the kid that was the most that had the most energy. I know that guy.
No.
He's protested all my stuff.
Really?
He shows up to everything. He screamed at me at the Kavanaugh stuff. And as soon as I saw the video, I was like, yeah, I know. It's the same eight angry SJWs that they rotate. They have like these regional.
I want to know, I asked the kid and all the kids that were screaming. I said,
What did I say that you disagree with?
Have they ever given you an answer on that?
Well, so I spoke at University of Nevada, Reno on Monday. So by the way, I feel as if we're like sharing war stories here, as if we're old, like, you know, war veterans.
Back
like,
when I was back, all those 18-year-old whippersnappers.
You were back in the 37 Airborne. Well, yeah. When we were invading, anyway. We're
what did you do during the Great War? I triggered snowflakes.
We all are right. Not comparing speaking on college campuses to military. I'm being very clear on Media Matters. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah,
we are not comparing.
Please,
oh,
no
my
more
goodness,
boycotts.
We're talking metaphorical. What I am saying, though, is that – so anyway, I spoke at University of Nevada, Reno on Monday. I was interrupted like 7 times by just different coordinated protests. And every time I said, can you please come to the front of the line and speak about why you're so upset? And then they go and storm themselves out. And so so enlighten me. What's your analysis of this? Because I talk about this a lot, you know, what we do at Turning Point USA. And tell me your analysis of that.
Let me give you the woke conservative point of view, which I did not used to hold until I was talking to a friend of mine over a cigar in D.C. She convinced me of this. The obvious issue is that these kids are ignorant, entitled, brats, badly behaved. They don't know anything. That's obvious.
Give me the woke take.
Here's the woke take. Their anger is perfectly legitimate. It's just misdirected. I know materially everything's going great. Things have never been better. Everyone's got jobs. Everyone's got money. But spiritually, culturally, religiously, our civilization has been hollowed out. The rot runs really deep. And by the way, these educational institutions have the task of educating the students. They don't do it. And so you have these kids who get to college.
That's very woke, by the way.
This is so woke. I've always prided myself on my wokeness. They get to college completely uneducated, completely uncultured. They've never been taught anything about religion. Increasingly, they're raised as nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not, unfortunately, N-U-N-S. They get to college with no sense of the moral order, no sense of purpose in life, no sense of who they are, what they're here for.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be pretty pissed off, too. And so they throw that anger onto you and me, because we go and talk about how George Washington isn't such a bad guy at George Washington University.
Yeah,
or any other,
you know, not that bad.
You're the worst person I've ever
seen.
Heads
explode. Mm-hmm.
Or I was at University of Missouri, Kansas City. I said, men are not women. People lost their minds. They put it on you because you are saying there is a moral order.
Does that give them an excuse to interrupt and to act that way?
And it's shocking to them. It's shocking to in a chaotic culture, simple truths are shocking to people. And so when you say men are not women, when you say George Washington isn't the worst guy in the world.
No, he was actually awesome.
He was one of the greatest men who's ever lived. King George III actually said that after the Revolutionary War. When they hear that, they're just so shocked by it. And that's not only their fault. There is the fault of their parents. There is the fault of their educators. And there is the fault of a shallow, hollowed-out society.
So do you think that excuses their behavior?
Well, everybody's responsible for his own behavior. What I think it does is it explains it a little bit. And it shows us – I think there's plenty of reason to be angry. Right now, stress, anxiety, depression, suicidality are through the roof. Huge proportions of young people are hooked on depression drugs. Suicide is up 70% among teenagers in just the last 2 years. Clearly something is profoundly wrong. And when you've got parents telling their little 3-year-old kid that because he puts on heels and he puts on makeup one day that he's actually a girl and they're going to block his puberty, something has gone dramatically awry in society. And they have every right to be anxious and stressed and depressed about it. And it's up to I hope it's up to us and other people to give them a sense of reality.
Does that argument, do you think – I'm going to reiterate my question. Does that argument you're making just give license for just this sort of behavior?
No. If anything, what I think it does is the opposite. I think what it does is say what you are doing is not only wrong, it's not only rude and poorly behaved and not in the spirit of the academy, but it will make you miserable. It's so corrosive that it will ruin
your
life.
I'm going to go back to this one guy. He's protested everything I've ever done on the Eastern Seaboard.
Right.
This one guy.
Yeah.
His identity is to go around and make sure that you and I are interrupted for 35 seconds. Which, by the way, thank you for interrupting Michael Knowles and giving him a viral piece of content.
That's right. Like, right. Of course, the message goes out much farther when some kid shrieks.
Some lunatic.
Yes. Let me tell you, you asked me if I had just come straight from Mass because I'm a religious guy. You're a religious guy. That kid who's protested you everywhere, he protested me. Something tells me he didn't come straight from Mass.
That's probably a safe assumption.
I think his religion is politics, as so many people are. I mean, there was a pro-abortion mob that came up to a pro-life group on a college campus. They were screaming, "Hail Satan!" I mean, there is some religious confusion.
What college is that?
This
UW?
UW. Oh my!
Was that GW?
It was actually a GW. I knew it. I wonder if I caused that. I mean, this is what I mean. There's so much. Mm-hmm. When you're a religious guy and you say, "Okay, I know I'm going to die. I know I'm not going to live forever, and then I can go to heaven, and I believe in Jesus, mm-hmm. and I go to Mass, and I have sacraments, and I have a coherent moral framework mm-hmm. and a framework of the universe." That kid doesn't have that, and so everybody's got to serve somebody. Everybody's got religion, and his religion is leftism. His
yes,
religion and
that's
his
exactly right.
His religious works is protesting you and protesting me.
So, do you think human beings are perfectible?
Of course not.
Good.
Of course not.
We agree on that.
I mean, this is a major distinction between the right and the left. The left believes,
I don't think we talk about this enough as a movement. And I know you do. I know that. But I don't think we being the
– Right. Because you know what we want to do?
The right. Exactly.
The right. We want to talk about tax rates. I mean, this – for so many decades, people just wanted to talk about tax rates.
I try to tell people this, is that it's so much deeper than that.
Of course. I mean, nobody cares about tax – I like low taxes as much as the next guy. But – when you're getting down to fundamentally different views of human nature, the left tells mm-hmm. us mankind is perfectible. There is
Plato.
Utopia, right?
Rousseau, Marx,
and Marx, right? What the right tells you?
Hobbes was the exact opposite. Hobbes believed that human beings are like vicious creatures.
Well, there's Hobbes in many ways begins this modern political project. But what conservatives believe is in something very basic, which is original sin, and you're not allowed to use religious language anymore. So you'd call it the fallen nature of man, imperfectibility. But it's obviously true. I can cite one example of a perfect man, and no more than that.
Jesus Christ.
That would be the guy.
Okay. Just making sure we're talking about the
same guy. I'm not talking about Trump. I mean, he's a good guy, but I wouldn't call him perfect.
No,
you know?
I wouldn't either. And so when I was on campus a couple days ago, and I asked a student, if the world acted more like Jesus, would the world be a better place? She said, no, immediately. It's stunning.
Hmm.
And so I say atheism is the fastest growing religion in America.
Yes. Well, yes. No religion is the fastest growing religion.
Okay.
You see this in the Pew religion surveys. It sounds like the same thing, but they're slightly different. It's the religiously unaffiliated. You always hear people say sometimes, I'm spiritual but not religious, which means I'm not interested in God or truth, but I find myself fascinating. So I'm totally into me. That religion of the self is growing very fast. That is not a traditional religion, and so they fall into this irreligious, religiously unaffiliated. But they have beliefs. They have works. They have sacraments. I mean, you know, just to look at leftism, NBC News put out the other day a climate confessional where you could go and anonymously confess your sins against the climate. I like that their religion is sort of modeled after Catholicism, but it's a wicked religion and it's a backwards religion.
Sure. And it's not rooted – I mean it creates widely unhappy people.
Yes.
Without a doubt.
It's misery, yeah.
And so are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of our country?
I think optimism and pessimism are two sides of the same coin because they're both feelings. The old line is about the Scottish optimist. Scottish pessimist says things can't get any worse. The Scottish optimist says, oh, yes, they can. And I'm neither of those things. I have hope. And hope is not just a feeling. Hope isn't a fleeting feeling. Hope is a fact. My Savior lives. That is real hope. And hope is a theological virtue. I have that. Doesn't mean things are going to be hunky-dory. Doesn't mean conservatives are going to win in 2020. Doesn't mean we're going to lower tax rates or whatever. Things are going to careen into oblivion. But I have hope.
Do you hope for our country?
Yes, of course. Hope springs eternal in the human breast. And America's got a lot of life left in her. Can we reverse this trend of decay? That I'm not so sure. I hope we can. I'm working toward doing that, and I know you are too. That's going to be a lot tougher because that's going to require not just a political revival but a cultural and a religious revival as well, and things don't look great.
What's the biggest misconception you find amongst students when you travel?
Oh, where to begin? I mean, there's nowhere to even begin on.
But if you had to pick one or two that really you believe are root causes of misconception.
The most prevalent misconceptions, the hottest issues, are gender. People are genuinely confused on this. They believe that there's a difference between sex and gender.
Yes, I hear this all the time. We did an entire podcast on this.
Well, you ask people, you say, what's the difference? And they'll say sex is biological.
And gender is choice.
Socially constructed choice. But then you say, okay, where is the gender? where on my body is the gender? They'll say, well, it's, you know, you just kind of think about it. You say, okay, so gender is a feeling. They say, no, it's not a feeling. I say, well, where is it? They'll say, well, it's in the brain. So if you're transgender, you know, your body is male, but your brain is female. I say, okay, so gender is biological too. The brain is a part of your body. It's probably the most important part of your body.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, okay, and then they get confused. And obviously there's no difference between sex and gender. Gender was not even a concept applied to human beings until very recently. It was mm-hmm. a grammatical concept to refer to different words. And so that's a big one. I mean, that they're indoctrinated.
I hear this all the time.
This is to me, the craziest one, because it's unlike other politically correct categories. It's not just making claims about class or race. Or sex, even.
It's so fundamental.
It's fundamental. They're making claims about the nature of reality itself and who gets to define reality. And that's mm-hmm. the biggest power grab I've seen the left make in history.
And I find students, if I had to just – there's a huge lies that I come across. One of the most prevalent in economics is that they believe that someone's enrichment came at the exploitation of another individual.
Right, right. They think GDP is stagnant. They think the economy is stagnant. It's just a pie chart.
Yes.
And if you want to grow, someone else has to shrink.
Correct.
Now, of course, that's not how economies work at all. What's the GDP of the United States?
$22 trillion.
$22 trillion. Yeah. What was the GDP in the year 2000? I think it was something like 11 or 12 trillion.
Even less, probably. Seven or eight, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean,
it was more than doubled over 10 years. Fastest growth of GDP in human history.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. And that doesn't even take into account the tech boom that happened in the 1990s. Wealth expands. There is a mm-hmm. lot of money. I mean, that's in part why we have so many nice things materially.
So that's number one. Number two, I find they fundamentally believe that the party switched in the 1960s.
Ah, this is very popular.
This is one of the biggest.
This is
but I go to root cause. Those are like the two biggest root causes. So, and not biggest, but those are the ones that if I could just deprogram that,
right.
and that, those two ones.
You know what I think is actually even more fundamental? I mean, truly fundamental. They don't understand the difference between a fact and an opinion and a preference. Because mm-hmm. here's what they think.
That's a great point.
They think that there's fact, and fact is true or false. And then they think there's opinion, and nobody can know if an opinion is true or false, or who knows. It's you do you. And then there's preference. And they just don't get it. So a fact is like we're talking into microphones. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my opinion. I think we are talking into microphones. That's an opinion. It happens to be correct. Here's my preference. I like microphones more than I like loud phones, more than I like a loudspeaker, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I like chocolate ice cream more than I like vanilla ice cream. That's a preference. There are true opinions. I try to convince people of this every day on my show. There are false opinions, and this cult of relativism, this tyranny of subjectivism mm-hmm. has forced whole generations of people to believe that they cannot rely on their own faculties of reason. They cannot rely on the objective reality they're seeing with their own eyes.
And so then what would you say? A preference would be people believe preferences are facts.
They believe that opinions are preferences, really. I mean, and they believe their own preferences are facts, by the way. But they believe that to say the sky is blue. To say I think the sky is blue, to say I think 2 plus 2 equals 4, they think that that's just a sort of a preference. It can neither true nor false.
Mm-hmm.
It's just subjective.
So it's the war on objective reality.
Yes.
Yes.
And if you can't
I find this too.
If you can't ground your discourse in objective reality, if there's no such thing as truth, it's just your truth and my truth, then there is no academy,
mm-hmm.
then there is no friendship, then there is no civil society, and there's no self-government. Self-government is based on persuading your fellow citizens with words, with speech. Let's not mm-hmm. forget politics is just speech. That's what politics mm-hmm. is communicated through. That's what it is. If you can't rely on that, then there is no self-government. There is no politics. It's just interests battling up against one another, and the strongest party is going to win.
Every single day, our great president, President Trump, is facing unprecedented obstruction and harassment from the liberal mob and their fake news allies. He's been exonerated twice, and they're still calling for his impeachment because they know Congress is their last hope. He needs your support now more than ever. text Charlie to 88022, that's C-H-A-R-L-I-E to 88022, and receive your official Trump alerts directly to your phone. I get them all the time. You guys got to sign up. Take out your phone right now, and you'll gain exclusive 2020 updates right from President Trump himself. Be the first to know when Trump merchandise is available, and you'll even be able to give your input on key issues to help shape the 2020 campaign. Again, all you have to do is text Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E, to 88022. When Democrats and the fake news media have spent the last 2 years focused on bogus witch hunts, President Trump has been working around the clock to make America great. Again, make sure you're getting your news directly from the source by texting Charlie. This is a way that you can help out the campaign. Do it right now. C-H-A-R-L-I-E to 88022. Again, be sure to text Charlie to 88022 today. This is paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again.
So to get kind of in just your feeling of predictions, do you believe President Trump will get reelected?
If the election were today, certainly. I think he would win. To quote Barack Obama, I think he'd win all 57 states if the election were today. But there are vulnerabilities. You'll notice he's not talking about the wall as much anymore. And the left isn't talking about the wall as much because he's actually building the wall now. So a significant portion of the wall is being built. And that is falling down. If you look at some of the polls.
The wall's not falling down.
The wall's not falling down. The wall's going straight up. But if you look at some of the polls, people care a lot less about the wall now than they used to. They care a lot more about the economy. They care a lot more about corruption in government.
I think that's the number one issue in America is corruption in government.
Is corruption in government. People don't trust the institutions.
That's why Elizabeth Warren, I think, is more dangerous than people realize.
Well, she's a big liar, though.
Of course she is.
She's not only did she lie about being a Native American.
She lied about being fired when she was pregnant.
Yes.
That's part of kind of like her whole shtick.
This is her whole shtick. She's the whitest, most privileged woman in the world.
It would like being finding out, oh, sorry, Trump actually was never on The Apprentice.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Sorry.
Who was that guy?
Like, that was not him. Body double. Nice guy. Wait, Trump was not in real estate? No.
No, not him.
It was Trump. That's what
it was. Trump. Right.
Kind of a minor detail. It was her whole stump speech.
So you think she's the big threat?
I'm a contrarian by nature. Not only do I think she's a threat, I think that I think she could win.
Really? You think she's going to win?
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Do you think there are more socialists out there than we probably would give ourselves credit for?
Yes, there are more people who say they're socialist out there than we would give themselves.
Do you think that Elizabeth Warren could get Barack Obama-style turnout in Wisconsin?
She could do well in Wisconsin. I'm not convinced she could do well in Pennsylvania. I'm not convinced she would do well in Florida. And Michigan, I'm not decided on. I think she could do pretty well in Wisconsin. She also has a little bit of a demographic problem, which is she has very little black support.
I think that's the greatest opportunity for the president.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. Because he does very well. As far as Republicans go, he does very well.
So when she draws 15,000 people in Minnesota in the middle of the summer, that worries me.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, that's Trump country. I mean, he lost Minnesota by half a point and won Wisconsin by 8,000 votes.
Right. The Wisconsin thing worries me. I never thought we were going to win Minnesota anyway.
A million human beings have given her money.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
And she's raised almost as much as Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
virtually
$26 million.
Yeah, 25, yeah. 26. And Bernie, and Biden, by the way, is way down. He's
so
like 15.
I think that we can't underestimate Warren the same way that the left underestimated Trump in a lot of ways. I think that the size of the crowds, the energy and the enthusiasm, and I think that there will be a consolidation around that. However, it presents a great opportunity for, I think, to turn this election into a culture war, which is what I think President Trump – that's the best – instead of talking about technocratic styles of government, which is what Mitt Romney ran in 2012,
right.
I can run government better than you and you're a wonderful person, but
exactly.
Really, give me the keys to the kingdom because I could put dogs in my car. Or I have car elevators, or I have, you know, something like that. I don't know. Or the trees are the right height, or whatever it was, right?
Right. A lot of my friends own NASCAR teams, right?
Exactly, yeah. Oh, I love NASCAR. So many friends own cars. It's like, really relatable. But Trump, I think, where his opportunity is to win is to make this whole election a referendum on America, make this a nationalized election
yes.
in a lot of different ways.
One of my favorite moments that Trump has had is when he was on that stage and he hugged the American flag.
At CPAC?
Yes.
That's the cover of my book coming up, by
is
the way.
It? No, is it really? Wow. Talk about a softball pitch.
I have the rights to that picture.
No, you don't.
Well, I mean, I got the rights for the book.
You got to lend it to me so I can blow it up and make it my
bedroom. No, it's him. It's
wall.
Just he looks so happy.
It's so great.
Literally the cover of my book.
People mocked him for that. They thought it was pandering. I don't think it's pandering. I think his whole political philosophy is I really like America. And frankly,
that's what my whole book is about.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I mean, to overly plug it.
That's pretty close to my political philosophy, too, is I really like America. And you see the left protesting the American flag. That's a stark contrast.
Every single day. So, OK, so you believe that if the election was held today, Donald Trump would win?
I think, yeah.
Okay. And you think Elizabeth Warren at the recording of this would probably be the nominee?
I think it's likely, though I'm far from certain on that. There are a lot of things that we can't predict. Bernie Sanders had a heart attack a week ago. Fortunately, he's alive, but that throws his campaign mm-hmm. into chaos. Joe Biden still has a chance, by the way. I don't think it's likely at all that he gets the nomination because I think he's not going to do that well in mm-hmm. Iowa, and he doesn't look like he's going to do well in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
He looks like he's going to do pretty well in South Carolina still.
Momentum's against him, though.
Momentum is against him. He's also going to get clobbered by impeachment. Impeachment is very,
totally
very bad
agree.
For him.
Yeah.
So right now it's looking very good for her. I wouldn't be surprised if Hillary Clinton got in at this point. Seriously. She's running in her own head, and she's running around the woods of Chappaqua, so I wouldn't be surprised if she ran for president. Seriously.
It would be a gift.
It would be Christmas come early. I'm strongly encouraging it.
So I believe – so one of the issues I think that where Warren can play offense against us, where she's being careful not to do this, but instead of condemning Trump voters – If the left showed compassion to Trump voters instead of mm-hmm. saying, how could you have voted for this guy?
Right.
Instead, if they say, I get it. I understand.
Yeah.
That's the tone where they could be successful in Wisconsin. I mean, do you think that someone in rural Wisconsin wants to be yelled at by some Democrat for voting for Trump? Like, yeah, thanks. Okay. Now I'm really going to vote for you after you call me all these horrible names.
And Trump did this very well in 2016.
He never insulted people that voted for Obama, ever.
And he actually complimented people who supported Bernie. And he took some of
their
voters.
I kind of get it.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's right.
And so – but I think that we as Republicans and conservatives don't talk about enough about the corruption in government.
Yeah.
I think Warren is making this a cornerstone of her campaign. Mm-hmm. She doesn't take money from lobbyists.
Yeah. Sort of.
Well, she look, there was an exception to that, but she's rejected money from federally registered lobbyists.
Yeah.
The exception is that she kind of built her whole political war chest with lobbyists throughout the years. Look, I'm not saying she's a shining knight, but there's something to be said, though, that people have a lot of anxiety about Washington, D.C.'s mm-hmm. kingdom that they've built
yes.
over our country.
Yeah.
Five out of the wealthiest counties, five out of the top 10 of the wealthiest counties, the top five are all around Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And so if we as conservatives become defenders of the government status quo and just say, oh, we're running this place fine, it's not that bad, I think a rebellion, like not French Revolution style, but the political equivalent of the Robespierre 1792 French Revolution could be coming.
They're going to storm the Bastille. AOC just came out and said we need to abolish prisons. So well, there are a lot of parallels.
Do you remember the quote was after us, the flood?
That's right.
And I don't want us to say, well, boy, you know, eventually they're going to get here. I'm one of the big things I'm focused on is as the left had the Green New Deal, we should have had a corruption in government campaign that, you know, McCarthy and all these guys, you know, really should champion. And it seems as if that's not happening.
And how do you do it is the real problem. I mean, President Trump has been stymied at every turn. He can't even fire people in the federal bureaucracy.
But isn't it not a great example? You have a whistleblower that didn't even hear the freaking phone call.
Of course.
You have
a whistleblower. I put that in quotes, a whistleblower.
Yeah, what are you blowing the whistle on? Right. Somebody told you? Like somebody has a secondhand account. I'm blowing the whistle. You didn't even hear it.
And if you look at that whistleblower complaint, some of the things he's complaining about are tweets and TV interviews. Thanks for blowing the whistle on that George Stephanopoulos interview.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, it's true. I don't watch George Stephanopoulos, so I guess someone needed to blow the whistle
who's
for
me. Clinton donor and was the Clinton communications director.
Right.
Football is in full swing, everybody, and our friends at betonline.ag, there's a great competition going on right now. We do very, very well. We seem to perform quite well, and we actually won the challenge a couple weeks ago. We didn't win this last challenge. That's okay. We are giving Adam Carolla and all the friends at Podcast One a fighting chance. Of course, this last weekend, the Ducks of Oregon beat Washington. We did predict that correctly. The Ducks won, and they are now number 11 in the country, and now people are already starting to say, hey, they might actually be a playoff contender. This upcoming week, we have Auburn at LSU. What a great game that is. I think LSU's going to win. I think LSU's the best team in the country. Wisconsin at Ohio State. Wisconsin's trying to avenge their loss from Illinois, which should not have happened. It was one of the biggest upsets in Big Ten history. Notre Dame at Michigan. That should be really great. Michigan needs that win to keep Harbaugh's job, essentially his relevancy alive. He's not doing too well. Penn State at Michigan State. I like Michigan State to kind of maybe pull an upset there. Penn State had a really big home win, and those sometimes have some hangover effect. Of course, we have the World Series. We have Houston versus the Nationals. I don't like anything to do with Washington, D.C., so I hope the Nationals lose. Oakland at Houston. I like Houston. Chargers at Chicago. Boy, my Bears are not doing well at all. But I think the Bears are going to turn it around. Green Bay at Kansas City. I like Green Bay, and Cleveland at New England. Of course, I like New England. Again, go to betonline.ag. Don't forget that promo code podcast1 for your 50% sign-up bonus. Betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts.
So I want to get into some other fun issues with the time we have left, which I don't think we agree on. So okay. You support the death penalty.
I do. I love the death penalty.
Tell me why.
Because we've completely lost sight of the purpose of justice, criminal justice.
Okay.
There are three purposes. Everyone agrees on rehabilitation. Most people agree on deterrence. Many people are forgetting about retribution. Retribution, justice itself, because a wrong has been done and that must justice must be exacted. The reason we've forgotten about that is because we've obviously lost sense of the moral order, but because it's kind of icky. We don't like the idea. Actually, though, retribution is the primary purpose of criminal justice. It's not just rehab. You and I have some bad habits. We could all use a little rehabilitation. Doesn't mean we should go to prison. Doesn't mean we go to prison when you commit an injustice and specifically when you break the law. That requires retribution, and some crimes require ultimate retribution, which is the death penalty.
So I totally disagree with you.
Okay.
I'm 100% against the death
Tell
penalty.
Tell me why.
Let me ask you a question, though.
Yes.
Do you think the state should have the power to kill its own citizens?
Yeah.
You do?
Of course. I think the state has a monopoly on violence. That's the definition of the state. We use it in
violence, not death, though.
Well, we kill difference. A lot of people overseas. I mean, we fight wars.
Those
wars.
Aren't citizens.
Those, sure. But the civil authority has the right to criminal justice. They have the right to arrest people for drunk driving. They have
sure.
the right to throw people in prison for 10 years. And they have the right to deprive them not only of their liberties, but to deprive them of their
so
life as well.
That's a reasonable answer. I'll disagree with it. I don't believe the government, both constitutionally and morally, should have the right to kill its own citizens.
But you would agree constitutionally it does.
How?
Because
cruel and unusual punishment is,
right.
is specifically cited in the Constitution.
The trouble is that the death penalty, I don't think it's particularly cruel, and it certainly wasn't unusual at the time of ratification. At the time of ratification, every municipality had the death penalty in the United States. And actually, the death penalty was the punishment for felonies. It was the definition of a felony was that you would be killed for it. And so we might have changed our opinion of it today. We might consider it cruel, and it has become increasingly unusual.
So it has become unusual. You would say that.
But if you're
it's rare.
If you interpret the Constitution with an originalist or a textualist lens, then you couldn't say that it's unconstitutional.
But we interpret it with a textualist lens, but we don't say, well, the Founding Fathers never would have anticipated the internet. We have the idea of what cruel and unusual actually meant back then.
Sure, but they could have probably predicted the internet, and they did predict the advance of firearms,
of weaponry,
for instance. Yeah. But the question of the death penalty isn't a question of technology. Obviously, we used to have the noose, and now we have the electric chair and injections, but the fundamental—
Which doesn't always kill the people.
Which doesn't always kill the
which
people.
Which is rather
right.
cruel.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, okay. I'm all for the guillotine. It's much sharper. But the question of the death penalty is not a question of technology. It's not a new question. It's actually an eternal question, and it's one that the Founding Fathers thought a lot about, and they knew a lot
about. So do you trust the government?
It depends. I have to trust the government to do certain things. I trust the government to get me my tax return more or less on time.
So,
I trust the government to pave most of the roads.
So over the last 30 years, there's 300 people that have been wrongfully executed.
Yeah, there. I mean, in any criminal justice system, there
but
will be
you can't go
mistakes.
Back once you kill them.
You can't go back when you take 20 years out of their life.
Sure you can. They're still alive.
They're still alive, but they've been, they've
like,
been
thank
rotting
you
for 20 years.
Not killing me.
Perhaps. Right. I mean, you know why I think this has come up? Obviously, I'm not using this in your example.
No, I mean, again, this is actually not even my top issue. It's just, I think it's interesting because
you
disagree.
You know why I think this has come up, though, largely? Is because of the decline of religion. Because if you have any system of criminal justice, there are going to be mistakes. Increasingly fewer mistakes, by the way, because of DNA testing. And because we err on the side of caution.
It cuts both ways. People have been exonerated through new DNA testing, too.
That are dead.
That's
what I mean. I know. It's too bad the technology didn't exist at the time. But the fact of it is, when you believe in God, when you believe that we don't just turn to worm food and take a dirt nap, when you believe that there is an eternal human soul, you fear the death penalty less. And all of human justice, all of our civil justice, is a simulacrum and a point toward that divine justice, which is justice indeed. If you believe that, then it's very sad when somebody is punished wrongly, when an injustice is committed. But there is ultimate justice. If you believe that this is all just a kind of a joke and it's all just matter and material, there could be nothing worse imaginable than wrongly executing somebody, than this sort of miscarriage of justice at the death penalty. But I certainly don't believe that. I don't think there's any evidence that the world is simply material and that there is no God. And I think that there is, in the end, for all of us, justice.
I think that the restraint of government power is inherent in being a conservative or a libertarian. So being restrained against this – government has a monopoly on power and violence, as you said.
Yeah.
But restraining that monopoly, I think, is what makes self-governance so special.
Sure. One thing that makes our self-government work very well, though, is locking up criminals. I mean, the fact that
due process and through a trial by jury.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying vigilantes need to go out, but I'm saying our civil authority is robust. People always knock.
Probably too robust, I would say.
Some would say people knock.
You and I might disagree on that.
We probably disagree on this. I mean, people knock what they call mass incarceration. I'm not as worried about mass incarceration because we still have relatively high levels of crime. They've decreased since the
90s. I sympathize. I think that we're locking up the wrong people.
Depends in what case.
So like an average rapist will spend 3 years in prison.
Right.
So I think life in prison, no problem.
Or castration, yeah.
Well, that's
– right. I mean, that
would be cruel. That would be cruel and unusual.
No, not necessarily. We chemically castrate rapists, and depends on the crime, and it depends on the area. And I think it'd be perfectly fine to – I think it's certainly fine to chemically castrate them. I think it's fine to get a little more physical too.
So the other issue with the death penalty is it's more expensive. Do you admit that?
Well, now it is because you don't actually kill them.
Because of appeals.
Right, right.
So, right, it runs up.
But I don't care about that. We have a lot of money. Our federal debt isn't being run up because of the death penalty.
But if you don't care about the little things, then you might not care about the bigger things.
But I don't put a price on justice. I mean, I'm really
– so that's interesting. So you look at – and I don't look at it this way. But you look at the purpose of our justice system to pursue, as you say, retribution.
Yeah,
some would say revenge.
No, not revenge. Revenge is the Lord's, but the civil authority does not engage in mere vengeance. The civil authority has the right to exact justice, and that's a perfectly biblical argument, and it's a moral argument, and it's been true in all of human society. They have the duty to do that, and I'm no utilitarian. I don't put a value on crime, and I don't put a dollar value on suffering. Adam Smith, who we both like very much,
he was a Stoic.
He was a moral philosopher.
He loved Marcus Aurelius.
He famously said, "Mercy to the guilty is cruelty to the innocent." I love mercy, and I think it's
good. No, I'm not saying release the murderer. I lock him up and throw away the key.
I think that's crueler, and it would have been unusual by the standards of the founding. I actually am of the opinion that life in prison is cruel.
I actually think that's the best argument against the death penalty. I mean, for the death penalty.
Right, because the alternative is really
bad. The best
bad.
Argument yeah. is that where people say, well, Charlie, to give you credence, not that I believe this, they say, but Charlie, you don't want what's cruel and unusual, but then you think that blocking them up is
for
actually more
50
cruel
years
and unusual.
Yes, yeah. And especially when you get into things like solitary confinement, which sometimes we do simply to get prisoners away from danger in the general prison population. Solitary confinement can be tantamount to torture.
I no longer trust our justice system. At all. Don't trust government's monopoly on power. In fact, I'm very skeptical of it. So I think there's few final things in life. Mm. Death would be one of those final things.
I don't think it's final.
Well, final as far as what we can control.
I don't know that we have that much control either. I mean, you know, I didn't decide to come into this world, and very good chance I don't decide how I leave this world either. This is a big difference between, say, a conservative and a libertarian. The libertarian has this idea that we own our lives, like our life is a possession that we own. I don't believe that. My life is a gift. It was given to me freely. I did not choose to create it. I won't choose when I lose it, and I'm a steward of that life, and I'm responsible to a higher power for that.
So if you believe that, then what choices do you believe are truly yours?
Well, I have free will. Just like when you lease a car, you don't own the car, but you can choose where to drive it, and if you want to throw trash all over it, and if you want to scratch it up. I have plenty of choices over my life. I have free will and I have intellect. But I am responsible for those choices. I am obligated to make the right choices. Mm-hmm. And if I make the wrong choices, I have to answer for that.
Right. So, but then do you think there's merit to designing laws that do protect the rights of the minority?
Oh, of course. I mean, that's frankly the main purpose of law, practically.
So then wouldn't we want a criminal justice system that would protect the rights of the wrongfully accused that then get killed?
Well, of course, the trouble is you can't create a justice system that protects the people who are wrongfully treated by the justice system. That becomes circular. The justice system is the justice system.
Well, no, of course we do, though. But we have trial by jury, which is part of the justice system, impartial.
Yeah, we have a very fair. I mean, we have
speedy and expeditious.
Right,
trial.
I think we have the fairest system of justice in the history of the world.
I think the UK is a little bit better, but that's different. That's a different time frame. I think they actually, at this point, they have a very English common law. I'm very fond of, but. So let me ask a question. Do you see evidence that the death penalty is a deterrent to crime?
Well, it is. There is evidence of this, though,
because
generally speaking, not as it's currently enacted.
Most people will push studies that it is not a deterrent to crime.
Yes. Well, when you have a – there are studies on both sides. But
that's why I asked the way it is.
Specifically, the problem is if you sentence someone to death and then they languish on death row for 35 years –
which is now the current system.
Which is the current system, and plenty of states have just – abolish the death penalty, not even through the legislature, but just by executive fiat. That very likely is not a deterrent, and that's what a lot of those studies show, is that doesn't deter people because there's no actual death penalty. And by the way, a lot of the time, while they're waiting to be killed, the governor of that state could abolish the death penalty, they could receive clemency, or in rarer cases, they could be exonerated. So in that way, it's not a deterrent. If we actually sentenced you and then you got killed relatively quickly, there's a lot of evidence that it would deter crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So very interesting with the death penalty, your stance. Totally disagree that I just don't.
Well, you and the Pope have that in common. He's very against the death penalty
as well.
Yeah,
that's probably one of the few things that we have in common.
I know. I might have convinced you to like the death penalty.
So I want to end on just a couple minutes we have here on just religion and God.
Yes.
What's the best argument when someone says, Michael, show me or prove to me why I should believe that God exists?
There are about a dozen good arguments that God exists.
What's your favorite?
My favorite is actually not the one I find most compelling. The one I find most compelling is the arguments of contingency, for instance. We are contingent beings, and you've got to go back and back and back. The arguments from the prime mover, the arguments from fine-tuning. I mean, they're all really compelling ones. Here's my favorite. Even though I'm not as compelled by it anymore, I love it. The ontological argument for the existence of God, specifically the modal ontological argument. It is not logically impossible that God exists, and God we will define very basically as the maximally great being. He has all the great-making characteristics, none of the corrupting characteristics. That's about as basic as you can get. It is not impossible that God exists. Therefore, God does exist in some possible world. Now, if God exists in some – just to use the language of analytic philosophy. If God exists in some possible world, then God exists necessarily in some possible world, right? He wouldn't – his existence wouldn't be a contingent truth. It would be a necessary truth because he's God. He's the maximally great being. If God exists necessarily in some possible world, then God exists necessarily in all possible worlds. If God exists necessarily in all possible worlds, then guess what? He exists necessarily in this world. It is the simplest argument. Nobody is satisfied by it, and I love it. I find it utterly whimsical.
What do the atheists say in response to that?
Well, atheists and other people would say that existence is not a predicate. So existence isn't a characteristic. You couldn't say that in the more simple formulation of that argument, you know, it's better to exist than not to exist, and because God has all the great-making characteristics, therefore he exists. You would say you that can't be a characteristic because it presumes something that you can't presume. That's one argument for it, or one argument against it, rather, which is a fair enough argument. The other problem with all of these arguments is that meaningful speech necessarily presumes the existence of God. So in a way, you are begging the question, even when you make these arguments. Mm-hmm. Reason itself cries out because God is the divine logic of the universe. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was mm-hmm. God. And the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. So all of those arguments are pretty good. I always flip the question back because we could go through some – I mean, just if you just look at the statistical chance that the universe exists as it does – with life, with us, you and I sitting right here, it is virtually impossible that that would happen, and yet it does. That's a fine-tuning argument. I would flip the question and say, what's the argument against God? Virtually every civilization everywhere throughout all of history has believed in God and a fairly similar version of God with a fairly similar conception of the moral order. You're the lone voice who says, none of that's true, it doesn't exist. Love, hope, my dreams, everything that matters to me is an illusion. We're really just meat. It doesn't explain my faculty of reason. It undercuts every argument I'm going to make, but that's what I believe. What I would ask that person is, what makes you so sure about that? What's your argument? Mm-hmm. And the argument they give you is the problem of pain, the problem of suffering. As though no Christian had ever considered the
like
existence
Aquinas
of evil.
Like Aquinas and Augustine never.
Yeah, and all the other ones too. And what you find out on that question is not only is that not an argument against God, that's an argument for God because we sing this on Easter. I mean, this is what Paradise Lost is all about when we sing, oh, happy fault that won for us so great, so glorious a Redeemer, that the world of incarnation and atonement is actually the greatest possible world, a greater world than a world without sin and death and suffering.
And the atheist would say what? I'll have to get back to
he would. Yeah, the atheist is always like, wow, that's deep, man. Wow, I have to
study up on that.
Right, because at that point, what you're showing to them is something that Dr. Johnson pointed out, which is their argument is so clear. Their argument is more or less this. I don't see God, therefore God doesn't exist. I can't see him.
Yeah.
That's a clear argument. It's a stupid argument, but it's a clear argument.
Ayn Rand would make that argument.
Ayn Rand makes plenty of shallow arguments. I like her a lot, but she makes plenty of shallow arguments.
Some things she was really good about, some things not so good about.
But what it shows you is Dr. Johnson's observation, which is all shallows are clear. All shallow thinking is clear. It makes a lot of sense to people who don't have a lot of sense. And deep things are murky, and they are profound. And when you expose people, because most of the atheists I talk to are not so clear in their thinking. They have these very clear little arguments, but they're not so clear in their thinking generally. When you expose them to that, to this well of thought that they haven't even contemplated, this well of existence, they quiet down.
I always say I don't have enough faith to be an atheist.
Exactly. I mean, it would require much, much more faith to be an atheist.
Without God, there would be no atheists.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. No, there are no atheists in the foxholes, and without God, there aren't any atheists, period.
That's right. There are no atheist foxholes. So at a different time, you and I will have to have a theological debate between Protestantism and Catholicism.
I was going to convert you today. I was going to become your godfather.
Right? Well, then give me your best argument for why I should convert to Catholicism.
Here's my best argument. You know, the usual argument is...
So I believe in the divinity of Jesus, the resurrection.
Right.
Believe in the authenticity of the Bible.
Excellent.
The four Gospels.
Right.
The testimony of early Acts of Jesus. You know, you would say the sainthood of Paul. I would say the ministry of Paul.
Okay, that's fine. So you're primed. You're ready to go.
So we're agreeing on more than we're disagreeing.
Yes.
So then bring me over.
Okay. A normal stumbling block is the Pope, and these days that can be a stumbling block to Catholics
as
well. So I'll ignore that.
Explain to me where it says that in the Bible.
Peter. Peter, you are...
Besides the anointing of Peter, where did it say that a succession beyond Peter needs to be institutionalized in Italy?
Well, they go to Italy. I mean, that's where...
They also went to Athens.
Sure. No, there is a universal church, and then the Bishop of Rome becomes the Pope and in early councils sort of decides between them.
Where did it say the power should continue to transfer past Peter for a singular Unitarian executive over the church?
Well, he you see it at the Council of Jerusalem. He's the final word at the Council of Jerusalem. He's the spokesman to the apostles, and they appoint successors.
Beyond Peter.
Because they appoint successors, for instance, right? They replace Judas.
But that wasn't Jesus. That was human beings making that decision.
It was human beings, but he became an apostle, right? He was replaced as an apostle, not just a random guy. And you hear this all the time. I mean, when Paul is writing to Timothy, for instance. You see this when they're writing to all of their disciples. Mm-hmm. They say, do what we have told you, both what we have written. I think this is in Thessalonians, what we have written and what we have passed down to you orally.
But Peter wasn't the sole apostle.
No, the Pope isn't the sole priest.
But he is the head of the of the whatever you want to call it, body politic or the entity of Catholicism.
He's the Pope, but there's – I mean that's why – the reason we have ecumenical councils is because power is so widely spread out among in the Catholic Church.
So do Catholics believe the Pope has a more divine connection to the supernatural?
No. What is it? More divine connection? He has the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and the he's a successor to Peter. Certainly, I mean he's the vicar of Christ.
But I will give Catholics credit for preserving the institution for over 2,000 years, despite a little bit of backlash.
This is my every 500 years we get a lot of backlash. Yeah. It's happening right now. My argument for Catholicism, like my basic one, this is my argument because it's not extolling the. Attractiveness of the Pope because at various times, maybe times we're living through, that's a difficult one. Here's my argument for it. Obviously, we do trace the Pope all the way back to Peter, and you can look at that.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. But it's the reality of it all. So it's not just that Christ says to Peter, on this rock I'll build my church. He also says to his apostles, you have the power to forgive sins. Whose sins you forgive are forgiven. Whose sins you retain are retained. He also says...
So that would be your argument for confession?
Is the institution of confession. He also says at the institution of the Eucharist, those who eat my flesh and drink my blood have life.
So now you're talking about transubstantiation?
Talking about the Eucharist, yes.
Okay, right. So for people that don't know, transubstantiation is the argument that it literally becomes the body of Christ when you take the
communion wafer, the host.
Right. When one of the sacraments, 8 sacraments or 9 sacraments, you believe
them? 7.
7. Okay. That's close.
So,
but here's my argument against that. Jesus talked in metaphors all the time.
Right. But when he talks about the Eucharist, you'll remember he says, those who do not eat my flesh and do not drink my blood have no life in them. Verily, verily, I tell you, my bread is true flesh.
He said the same thing about baptism.
What did he say about baptism?
He said, if you're not baptized, I don't know you, basically.
Yes, I think baptism is a sacrament as well.
So I agree. Well, I think communion is a sacrament, but I don't think it literally becomes.
But he says, he says you need to be baptized, which is true.
Right, but Jesus doesn't say that the baptism, you're literally becoming Jesus or that you're.
Right, but he never said that.
Right, but where do you draw the distinction between the many metaphors he says throughout
the New
Testament?
Well, what's the metaphor?
The metaphor is the bread.
Right.
Or the wine.
But metaphor is the key to it here. So what he says about baptism is literally true, and what he says about the Eucharist is literally true. And he makes such a point about it that you'll remember the crowds went away after he said it because it was a hard saying. It was such a hard saying when he said, it is true flesh, it is true blood, it is true food. They went away, and the apostles stayed, and he said, you have stayed. And the apostles said, where shall we go? Where else would we go? Because he is Christ. And this is on a broader level.
But didn't he say, do this in remembrance of me, almost as a metaphorical remembrance of Jesus?
At the Last Supper, yeah, we do it in remembrance of him. But I don't know if it's metaphorical. I mean, the word is probably most literally translated to a sort of memorial sacrifice.
But the significance of it is that in the Catholic tradition, you believe that it actually physically becomes Jesus within you, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
My body is true food. And the reason this is important is not just the scripture of it all. The reason it's important is gets to the heart of the matter itself, which is what is a symbol? You know, one big disagreement between many Protestant denominations and the Catholic Church is whether the host, the Eucharist, is a symbol or whether it is the true body of
Christ. Well, that's what I was saying by metaphors.
Exactly.
Symbology
it's a metaphor.
Versus metaphorical. Sure.
And what is a symbol? A symbol represents the symbolized. The words that we're using right now are symbols, and the symbols represent real things. Our bodies are in many ways symbols of ourselves, which is not just body, but body and soul as well. There is the physical world. That's what we're all touching. And then there is the metaphysical world. And in the incarnation, in Christ himself, is the union of the two, the creator of the universe and the creation, the metaphysical and the physical. In the sacraments, you see that same unity and you experience them with regularity. This is why the sacraments are so important. I'm just speaking anecdotally, but the plural of anecdote is data in this case. Human beings need a regular encounter and a real encounter with the metaphysical. They need the symbol and the symbolized to be united. That's what the sacrament is. And the Blessed Sacrament, the Eucharist, is this perfect sacrament, this perfect union of the physical and the metaphysical. It's not disjointed. It's not disconnected. We're not living some Gnostic dualist heresy where transgenderism, for instance, is a Gnostic dualist heresy.
Sure, and so the Protestants, the tradition, we still take communion.
Right.
We don't discount it as a superfluous
right.
exercise. The difference would be that we look at it as symbology or metaphorical, mm-hmm. not as experiential.
Right. And the question is, how far away is the symbol? Because we experience metaphor all the time. And so, of course, when you go through the same act of eating the communion as the symbol of Christ, but is there a moment in other than in the sacrament where the symbol and the symbolized are not so far apart, but they are truly united?
So you believe
as
they could be inseparable?
They are, yes, they are unified in the Eucharist.
So but when I hear Jesus say, "I'm the door," and I walk into a door of church, I don't think that's Jesus.
He's the door. The door is not Jesus, but Jesus is the door.
Right, but when Jesus said, "I'm the bread,"
right?
This is my body.
Yeah,
you know, do this in remembrance of me. The wine is my blood. Do this.
Right.
The Protestant interpretation would be, this is how we remember Jesus Christ, not how we experience Jesus Christ.
Well, we do it in remembrance
you do it
of
with
him
both.
And what he's doing,
but
memorial sacrifice.
Right,
yeah.
But you use the word metaphysical.
Right. Well, when he says this is my body, the bread is my body, he's obviously speaking in metaphor. The question
yes.
is, what is the nature of that metaphor? And Christ himself is a metaphor, right? Because Christ himself is both fully human and fully divine. How is that possible? He's a metaphor, but he's the sacrament. He is the union of the human and the divine, perfectly and fully each. That is what we experience regularly in the sacraments. And so I'm not saying in any way that people are wrong to think of mm-hmm. the communion as a symbol. It is a symbol. The next question you have to ask is, what is a symbol?
Mm-hmm. So you said there was other arguments you wanted to make for Catholicism?
Yes, that's
super quick.
That's a good one. So I think that's kind of
you haven't told me, sold me there.
I haven't. Okay, I've moved you. Maybe not. I don't know.
You did. You opened my eyes on a couple things there.
Yes.
To think
so
about.
So that to me is the most compelling one. And here I'll give you a practical reason.
Okay.
Based on that last argument, here's the practical reason. I've been to plenty of Protestant churches. Sometimes I hear great sermons, and I love that. And I walk away and I think, God, that was great. Sometimes I hear not so great sermons. That's too bad. When I go to Catholic masses, more often than not, if I'm traveling, I hear very bad homilies.
Almost
always. Terrible homilies, almost always.
The worst.
The churches I go to, really great homilies, but there are like four of those churches in the country. The rest, very bad. Now, that's too bad. But that's not why I go to the Mass. This is why the Mass is fundamentally different than other church services, because I go to the Mass to participate and to experience this highest form of prayer and this worship of God that is being led by the priest, and to receive the sacrament. So even if the priest is just babbling some leftist nonsense that is completely incoherent and half heretical, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You are not there for that. I read my Bible, I say my rosary, I read my apologetics. I can learn a lot outside of, but what I go to the Mass for is something separate, and it's a yeah. prayer, and it's specifically the highest form of prayer.
So two things.
Yes.
Traditionally, during the Catholic Church has changed because the Catholic Church never used to empower its parishioners to be able to read the Bible, because most people couldn't read in the 800s
well, that's
and
not,
900s.
Illiteracy wasn't the fault of the Catholic Church.
But the Catholics for a long time believed in basically having control of the text. Massively distributing it.
Well, I mean, they're not going to give out free Bibles. Books were very expensive in the 16th century.
No, but there was a belief, and it's still some of this carries over to this day, that people must have a guide as they read the Bible.
Well, it's helpful to have an interpretive scheme. That's true if you read Huck Finn too. I mean, it's not only true of the Bible, but this is a legend. This legend that the church was hiding the Bible from everybody. I mean, and it's based on some reality. The Bible was literally under lock and key in many churches in the mm-hmm. Middle Ages. But the reason for that is the Bibles were extraordinarily expensive and they would be stolen. But to use a good example, Christopher Columbus, before he sailed to the Americas, Christopher Columbus is living in the 15th century. He was a man of low birth who was obsessed with the end times and obsessed mm-hmm. with reading the Bible. And he read the Bible with Franciscan brothers regularly, and they would read it with him, and he taught himself to read. And so obviously the Mass itself exposes people to the Bible and all of that Catholic art. So what you are right about here and what you're getting at is that the Catholic Church claims to have the keys to the kingdom of heaven and prevents different translations, say, that contradict certain things or that change certain words or that take out certain books. Mm-hmm. And the Catholic Church does claim religious authority. That's certainly true. Now, I notice smaller churches also claim religious authority, maybe in different ways, but I think it's a myth. I think it's a longstanding one, but a pernicious myth that the Catholic Church is hiding knowledge of the Bible.
So you find you said when you travel to Protestant churches, a little bit of inconsistency. You don't know what you're always going to get.
Well, that's true of Catholic churches too, though, in terms of the homilies.
The
homilies are
they're
pretty
trying to
bad
teach
in a lot of places.
Also the experiential side, you think, is very consistent then. Same scripture being read worldwide, the same type of experience.
It depends on the Mass. I mean, it is the same experience in that you receive the Eucharist. That's what it comes down to, is the Eucharist itself.
Do you think you're putting too high of a premium on the Eucharist?
No. I don't think anyone could possibly put high enough a premium. I am so underplaying and
Why do
underselling.
You think that?
Because it's Christ himself. It is Christ.
What if it was just a metaphor?
What is a metaphor?
I mean, no, but what if Jesus was actually just talking about metaphor?
You mean what if it were just a piece of bread?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then I wouldn't value it all that much.
Okay, so what if that was lost in translation? Because the amount of data and supporting evidence for the Christian tradition, the Christian beliefs that Jesus has that are widely supported in most of the Catholic and the Protestant tradition is supported through many different texts. The idea of symbology versus literalism of the experiential Eucharist. Do you think you're too – you say you're not putting too high of a premium on the Eucharist?
No, not at all. I mean, there have been great debates in the Church since the very beginning. I mean, there have been – let's not forget the debates of Arius and the Arians who denied the divinity of Christ himself. And then Santa Claus, St. Nicholas at the Council of Nicaea punched Arius right in the face because he got so sick of him. These debates have gone on for a long time. But it is also the case that for at least the first 1600 years of the Church, there was broad agreement that – the Eucharist is the Eucharist. This was true up to and including Martin Luther and the Eastern Orthodox Church and many of the early Protestants. And the idea that this was all just a big farce and a big charade.
Well, I never
coast
said
to coast.
It was a farce, but I mean. But
the idea that it was totally wrong, and in this case, fundamentally wrong, is a relatively new idea. And I'm not saying there aren't arguments that are made for that. I just don't think they're terribly compelling.
Well, we'll have to continue this conversation theologically then.
Excellent.
And I'm still trying to figure out why your Bible has all these extra books.
Yeah. Oh, they're great. You got to read them.
Maccabees.
Really, yeah. Right? Maccabees is terrific. Especially Maccabees is terrific.
Yeah. We don't have Maccabees. We have the Reader's Digest version.
I know. Once you read it, Maccabees, then you'll get into purgatory. You'll get into it intellectually, maybe physically.
Well, we could talk about the afterlife too and all that, which is a whole different thing. Because
we're in the after time right now.
I think so. Well, Michael, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Charlie, thanks, man.
God bless
all
you.
Right.
Thanks.
You too.
What a great conversation with Michael Knowles. Please go to your podcast app right now, Apple Podcasts, type in Charlie Kirk Show. If you're not yet subscribed, press subscribe. Get one friend to do the same. Go down and leave a review. Press 5 stars. If you want to get engaged with Turning Point USA, you can go to tpusa.com. Again, that's tpusa.com, the nation's largest student movement dedicated to free enterprise and American exceptionalism. Again, that's tpusa.com. As always, a big thank you for listening to our show. We'd like to ask a small but very important favor of you. It'll only take a few minutes, and if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time. Literally, we need you to complete a short survey because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and you as a listener. Go to podcastone.com/survey and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. The first 250 people who complete the survey will get a $10 gift card to Amazon.com. Free money. It's like Andrew Yang. And 2 grand prize winners will be selected at random to get a $100 Amazon gift card. How about that? Free money, it's a win-win. Our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us cater to the needs of you as a listener. So please go to podcastone.com/survey, answer some questions, and potentially make more money along the way. Thank you so much for being a dedicated listener to The Charlie Kirk Show.